This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Now you're here on Detours with Lindsay and Greg.
I found it very difficult to get out of bed this morning. I was sort of all rugged up and the alarm went off. And not yet. Set the alarm again. And in the end, the toes just had to hit the ground, I'm afraid. They do. Yeah, they will. They hit with a thud every morning, I can assure you.
We're also joined today by a fantastic gentleman. I think one of the leaders of our community for inspiring other people is Noel Tovey. Welcome, Noel.
Hi, Greg.
And you are. You're inspiration. And I'm sorry to say that to you because I know it's pushing your buttons, but you are. You inspire me and you inspire countless other gay men in particular and other lesbians about your passion for life and the things you do.
Well, that's really what my agenda in my later life has been to inspire all gay people that they can live an ordinary life or a life, whatever life they want to live, and they don't have to be answerable to anybody.
Absolutely, Nolan. And, you know, I've sort of noticed, you know, because I'm no longer 25, which is probably painfully obvious, but what I've noticed is there's been so many shifts in attitudes and what is important to our community. Like at the moment, it's gay marriage. What was the, when you first came out, and or acknowledge your sexuality, what was the major focus then, if there was one at all?
There wasn't.
Mm.
And I've actually been out since I was 12 because I was a hustler and a street kid. And and then at the age of 17, I was arrested for the abominable crime of buggery and sent to Pentridge Jail. The death penalty was on the statutes in those days for that particular crime. The police actually raided a drag party, as they were called in those days, and it was at the home of a famous female impersonator. They weren't called drag queens in my day. They were really female impersonators. They lived as females, worked as prostitutes on St. Kilda Road, worked in the illegal baccarat clubs. And this person was Max Jubari.
I've heard that name.
Yeah. And the police took me down to South Melbourne Station, police station, made me sign a confession. I wasn't aware of the seriousness of the crime, of course, and they used words I didn't understand, and finally they handed me this sheet of paper which I signed, and I was really signing my own life away.
Good God.
So you can see from that, we're going to unpack a really different detour today. We're going to talk about Noel's travels and what's happening in his life right now in 2012, and we're going to draw some of the experience and some of your past experiences, some of that longitudinal detour that you've had through your life into today's current time, and unpack who Noel Tovey is and why he's so important as a man, but as a person that we have in our community.
Mm.
So stay with us.
There's been many detours.
Well, what's your... And you've loved every one of them?
What's your most recent detour, Noel?
I went to... I've just come back from New York. I went to see my adopted granddaughter. She's at the Alvin Ailey Ballet School. I say adopted because when I was a director and choreographer in London and Europe, my assistant was an American dancer, and like most dancers, left it too late to have children. And with my help, she and her husband went to China and bought a baby girl from an orphanage when she was a few months old, and I go to New York every year for her birthday.
Oh, how beautiful. How old is she now?
She's now 13.
Fantastic.
And making her Broadway debut this year, this season.
Fantastic.
Now, how proud would that be to have her on Broadway with your connections to the theatre?
Well, it would make me very proud, particularly as my own daughter died from a heroin overdose. And it took me a long time to come to terms with that. And now seeing Jade blossom, and she's just received a part scholarship to go to Stanford. She's brilliant, actually.
That's awesome. That's awesome. How did you get involved in theatre?
I made my debut, as it were, in 1948 in a musical in the old Cathedral Hall in East Melbourne, starring Bunny Brooke and Frank Gutliff. I played the schoolboy. It was called Sunshine and Rain. I've never forgotten it. But how I became a dancer is another story. I was wandering through the streets of Melbourne one night, and a police car stopped, and a detective who knew me said, "No, get a job, or you're coming with us." So next day I got a job at Collins Book Depot, and there was a girl working there, and she took me under her wing that very first morning. She smoked black Sobrani cigarettes. She told me she was a lesbian and going to be a famous writer, and really we should go and live in Paris on the Left Bank, where everyone was existential.
Love it.
I didn't understand that at all. But anyway, she took me to the ballet one night, and at the end of the male solo, she said, "You know, you could do that." And I sort of knew I could. But I didn't know how to go about it. So the next day we went to Payne's Bon Marché in Bourke Street, which was just opposite here, actually, up the road a bit. And I bought a pair of long white underpants for 12 and 6 and a packet of Dolly dye for a penny, and I dyed them black, the underpants black, in the old copper in the backyard, and took myself off to my first ballet lesson in homemade tights and bare feet. At the end of the class, the teacher asked one of the boys to take me aside and introduce me to the mysteries of the jockstrap.
And I have to ask, Noel, whether the Sobrani-smoking lesbian ever did become a famous writer and live on the Left Bank.
Well, not live on the Left Bank, but she did become famous in Melbourne. And quite a well-known person and writer. And
can you tell us who she is?
She still lives with her girlfriend in Phillip Island. Well, I suppose I can. I've named her in my book. It's Cheska.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Fantastic.
Cheska and I go back to the 50s. Early, well, 1949, I think.
So when you roam through the streets of Melbourne, there are places in Melbourne that have a real strong connection to Noel and how you developed as a young
man. I often take friends on tours and I walk. I say, "Look, I picked up so-and-so there." And and I sold newspapers there. Yeah.
Fantastic. And for a while you were away from Melbourne. So coming back to Melbourne,
I lived away for 30 years.
What was it like to set foot back in your hometown and connect to those memories and those instant thoughts? You visually see a place that links back to your past.
Do you know, I've had no regrets about coming home whatsoever. People have asked me if I have any regrets because I gave up my gallery in London and a certain career I had. But Melbourne is my home. And, you know, being Aboriginal, that has another extension as well. But because in my culture, this is my home. It's my land. You know, I don't walk on the land. I'm part of it. Mm. And I'm part of Melbourne.
So returning to your land, returning back to the land of your ancestors, the land of your current relatives, the land of you, is such a poignant moment.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. Mm. In fact, now, when I have a little problem in my head or whatever, I just go up and out into the bush and I sit and I think how lucky I am.
Yeah, that's important, Noel, I think, you know, with anybody's journey, well, their life journey, is that I grew up in Williamstown, and whenever I'd get really grumpy about anything, my mother would just say, you know, go across the road, because we live right on Port Phillip Bay, go across the road, and I'd sit with my feet in the water on the end of a pier, which is a little bit different. But it is that thing about, and I noticed even when you travel, sometimes when you come home, just to the earth feels like home.
Oh, it does. And I first came back, well, it was more than 20 years. In fact, one of the newspapers that vilified me during my trial wrote an article about me, and the same newspaper said, "Local boy makes good." I thought, well, local boy makes bad, actually. Because once I'd started getting some recognition in the West End and Europe and America and places, I was invited back to Australia to do various shows.
Now, you're on Detours with Lindsay and Greg. We're with Noel Tovey. We're going to explore, I think, straight after this little piece of music, we're going to explore Noel and how he actually came to make it on the West End. How did he actually make that step and become a name that people would listen to on the West End? You're on Detours. A fabulous show. Stay with us to the hour on Joy 94.9.
It's not a thing that I would change, 'cause you're amazing just the way you are. And when you
fresh sound you're looking for, Joy 94.9.
You're on Detours with Lindsay Curley from Greg Atkins and our special guest, Noel Tovey. Welcome back, Noel.
Thank you.
And before we went to that beautiful bit of music by Bruno Mars, which is Just the Way You Are, I thought we'd explore not just your most recent trip to London, but past trips as well, and your first trip to London. So when was your most recent trip to London?
The most recent trip to London was last year when I performed my autobiographical play, which is called Little Black Bastard, for the Origins Festival in London. That was quite interesting for me to do, because the year before I'd done it at the Edinburgh Festival, and the year before that I was diagnosed with cancer. So in Edinburgh I was doing it with a colostomy, and London was the first year after I'd had the colostomy reversed, so I wasn't quite sure whether I could even do it or not.
And you got through?
I got through it, and I was interviewed by Libby Purvis, who I'd known for 30 years or more, on the BBC, and she'd rounded up some really old friends like Kenneth Cranham and some other old chums. And friends of mine who I hadn't seen for, 30, 40 years, heard the interview and came to see the play from all over England, actually.
And what was that like, having these faces that had, you know, probably hadn't seen for 10, 15, 20, 30 years even, and they were there lapping up every word?
Oh, that was a wonderful experience for me personally. Just seeing old friends again, people who I'd known, like... A group of them gave a dinner for me at the Chelsea Arts Club, which I was a member there 40 years ago, and Chelsea Arts Club hasn't changed at all. And old friends who'd now become, some had become very successful, others who had given up their careers or whatever. That was really great. It was really wonderful for me to do that.
Now, the London of 2011, what was that like, seeing such a stark change, I assume, from the London of your first visit?
For one thing, it was hideously expensive. Like, when I first went to London, it was 1960, and I was principal dancer with Sadler's Wells. I got my second job, actually. And I'd get up at 6:30 in the morning and have breakfast and pay a penny on the bus to go across to Rosebery Avenue, where we'd do three classes in the morning, have a break for lunch, rehearse in the afternoon, have another break, and then do a performance in the evening. I'd get home at midnight, another penny on the bus, and for that I was paid £8 a week. That was, you know, the others were paid £6, and one could live on that, you know, quite easily.
In the London of 2011, what was that like in terms of costs?
The management paid for my accommodation, but the year before, when I'd on my way up to Edinburgh, I'd stayed in Chelsea in an old hotel which has now been converted into studios, but it was £500 a week, which is just over $1,000 a week.
Good God, and to think, you know, once upon a time you were earning £8 a week.
Yeah.
And getting around, which is, 50 years ago, which sounds like a long time, but in essence, you think about it.
And saved on that as well,
yeah.
A little bit.
Unbelievable.
Now, the two Londons, the London of then and the London of now.
Oh, the London then was swinging. I mean, literally, when you talk about swinging London, it was. I mean, you know, I'm not going to mention names, but I knew all the pop people, because they were all starting, and my good friend was George Harrison, and because his wife Patty was Patty Boyd, a model who I knew very well, And that's how I got to know George, through Patty. But, you know, I remember for the opening night of O Calcutta, which I was in. In fact, Joe Orton wrote a sketch that I did. We had the day off, the day of the opening, and I went to Carnaby Street and bought a pair of crushed velvet. They were bright green crushed velvet flares.
And a fake, gorgeous.
And a fake ocelot belt. And a shirt that was... I've never forgotten it. The shirt was sort of pale lemon with tiny blue cornflowers and hideously tight with a huge lapel. It was wonderful.
Because that, I mean, we only just see, you know, that stuff from history, you know, because that era actually absolutely.
And there were a few hidden
me.
Gay clubs as well.
Yeah, there was. But how did you feel?
The A and B club was one. The Carousel was another. The Carousel was really, you went if you. In the upper classes, you know, the aristocracy went to the Carousel.
Did you ever pinch yourself, Noel? Because, you know, in 1960, Australia was pretty much still a bit of a backwater. Like nobody, I suppose, you know, was still a bit of a colony as seen by some. Did you ever sort of, while you were buying those flares or hanging out with George, just sort of pinch yourself and think, God, I'm a little Aussie kid?
I did. My first job, I did that. I couldn't believe it. I'd been in a musical here at the Princess called Once Upon a Mattress, and the director and choreographer was George Carden, an Australian. He saw Mary Hardy and I in a late night review in a little theatre in Richmond, which no longer exists. And he said to me, you know, no, review is your métier, you should come to London. So eventually I went to London, not too long after that, actually, the following year. And I called him and I said, George, I took your advice, it's Noel Tovey, I'm here. He said, good. And after a few pleasantries, he said, if you can find your way to the folk dance society in Regent's Park, I'm rehearsing a show for television and you can work for me again. Well, I arrived and I didn't realise within those first few weeks I worked with Vera Lynn, Elmer Cogan, Judy Garland, and, you know, I kept pinching myself every day.
Wow. I'm just absolutely in awe of you because, you know, like Judy Garland, everybody thinks I'm a queen because I love Judy Garland. But it's sort of like, you know, when you meet somebody that's had a connection with these people, you look, honestly, I could sit down and listen to you for hours talk about it. But after that first production, like we always hear that, you know, artists are constantly out of work, whatever. How close was your next production as a young man in London?
Not too close. Mm. You know, I was out of work a lot. I mean, I can talk about the glamorous things I did, but I could also tell you about the number of part-time jobs I had, and washing up dishes was a reality for me. But I always had this one aim in mind, and that was to have a career. Mm. And so I didn't mind the part-time jobs or living on the dole. In fact, the dole office in Chadwick Street, which is everyone was entitled to get the dole. So you'd see Rolls Royce pulling up with a famous, well-known star stepping out to collect her £2.10.
My God.
I had another...
It doesn't happen now.
I had another connection with Judy Garland many years later. I studied jazz dancing in New York with Luigi and mathematics. And I went there after I'd finished a show I was doing in 1969 and to have some classes with Luigi. And the evening of Judy's funeral, the day of her funeral, a friend of mine at class said, let's go for dinner uptown. So we went uptown. Afterwards, he said, let's continue the wake. We'll go down to, I know this club where they're having a big wake. It's called Stonewall Inn. Mm. And so we jumped in a cab and we went. By the time we got down there, the whole of Sheridan Square was a riot. The police were out. What they'd done is the police had raided Stonewall. Now, all the clubs in New York were controlled by the mafia. Mm. And they used to make token raids. And this night, they raided Stonewall. Well, the night of Judy Garland's funeral was not the night
to
run.
Not to do it, no.
And so the drag queens there stood up and picked up the high stool, bar stools, and hit the police with them, threw bottles of grog at them, everything. Thousands. So we joined in chanting gay power, gay power. And the police formed the V formation, took out their batons and walked down Christopher Street beating us with the clubs. And we kept chanting as we were bleeding, gay power, gay power. But then I realized that if I'd if I was arrested, I'd never be allowed to go to New York again. I'd have my visa revoked. So I said to my friends, look, I have to get out of here. And we went to another bar.
Because that is such a pivotal event in gay history. You can't deny Stonewall as being, you know, the night of change, really, can you?
Oh, it's our Armageddon. The night, yeah. And the next day, the next morning, there were 4,000 people on the street. Brilliant. And gay liberation started the gay, you know, all these groups that wanted to have a voice were there.
Mm. And they could never put the cap back on the bottle.
Never again. Mm. In fact, after that, took a while, but gay clubs became legal in New York.
You know, and I can't help, you know, sometimes when you look at those images of Stonewall, and there's a couple that I've seen, you just see the look of horror on the police. Yeah. Faces, because you know there was this attitude that gay men were very feminine and you know, we don't need to go into it, but you can just see the look on their face, like, oh my God, these guys are fighting back.
Well, and what was even more frightening in a sense was New York was very dangerous in those days, and gay men wore whistles on chains around their neck, and if someone attacked you, you'd blow your whistle and other gay men would come and help you. And to hear at least 4,000 whistles being blown was the most eerie sound I've ever heard.
Now, you're on Detours with Lindsay and Greg and our special guest, Noel Tovey. Coming up, not just now, but coming up, you'll be able to ring Joy 94.9 on 1300 569 949 for a double pass to Melbourne Symphony Orchestra, Melbourne Town Hall, Saturday 26th of May. Experience the best of British, where the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra performs William Walton's biblical spectacular, Belshazzar's Feast, and Britten's ever-popular Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra. Now, that's coming up shortly. Stay with us. Don't ring the phone now, but after this little bit of music dedicated to Noel Tovey, you can. You're on Detours on Joy 94.9.
I am what I am. I am my own special creation.
Check out our podcast on the Joy website, joy.org.au.
Now, you're here on Detours with Lindsay and Greg, and our best wishes to Jody, who's out there today. Thank you, Jody. See you back on the Detours crew next week. And our special guest, Noel Tovey. Now, Noel, before the break, we talked about your experience at Stonewall, being there the night of Judy Garland's funeral and the riots that took place, the pivotal riots for gay community, not just in New York, but the world, around activism and standing up and rights.
I still have a scar on my forehead.
What's it like when you go for a wander down the streets of New York in this century, and you think back now about difference, and you walk through those same streets? What goes through your mind?
Well, it's been cleaned up a lot. Giuliani cleaned up 42nd Street. When AIDS struck, a lot of the gay bars and clubs, which were down around 12th Street, the old meat market, they closed down. It's become a lot safer, those areas. In fact, 12th Street now has boutique shops. One time, the meat market, well, it was, the trucks would deliver meat around New York during the day, and in the evening, they'd all park down around the meat market area. And they were the hottest cruising areas in town. Inside those trucks were wild bacchanalian scenes. And underneath the trucks, guys used to hang out, and young college kids would come over and unzip their fly and, you know what, and get a blowjob, and off they'd go for the evening.
The wild New York. And today...
That doesn't happen anymore.
Today it's all gentrified and, you know, Sex in the City, you know, that sort of thing. It's all been, you know, it's all very nice now.
And people hanging out at the boutique shops looking for a fitting.
Yeah.
In fact, I bumped into a friend of mine from Sydney, she was well known in the 60s, Madame Lash. And she said, darling, she said, I've just been to the, or some club, I can't forget the name. She said, you can't put it in anymore.
How times change. You did touch on there on the impact of HIV as it took off and became a pandemic around the world.
Yes. I was in New York and on a buying trip for my gallery. I had a gallery as well as being a director and choreographer. And I went down to Christopher Street with some friends to a bar, and there was a poster saying gay circus to raise funds for gay cancer. And I said, what on earth's gay cancer? And a friend of mine, Fred, said, well, you know, we're too old. That was one of the myths surrounding it in those days. It's a cancer that's striking down young gay men. Well, a few weeks later, I saw the first documentary about HIV. And now, for months before this, my late partner, Dave, my long-term partner, who was one of the first to die from AIDS, in fact, we were together 17 years, and he died, he'd shown me a bruise on his leg. And he went to many, many different doctors in London who said, well, you do have a blood disorder, but we don't know what it is. Then I saw this documentary, and I started crying. And a friend of mine who was watching it with me said, why are you crying? I said, that's what Dave has. So I organized a dinner with a friend of mine from the sexually transmitted disease section of St. Mary's Hospital in Praed Street, a young New Zealand psychologist who still is a very good friend of mine, and his wife, and Dave. And during the evening, I brought the conversation around to this new virus. And Alana, nurse, said to Dave, why don't you come and let us test your blood? He said, oh, you don't think I have it, do you? And she said, well, it'd rule it out, wouldn't it? Well, then he went and she rang me and she said, you know, it's positive, Noel. I said, well, don't tell him without me being there, because there was no medication at all. And people were already, friends of ours were already dying. So he was told what he had, and a part of St. Mary's in Praed Street, the top floor of one part of, they turn into the wing or the floor for this particular disease. And Dave's doctor said, Tony said to me, no, use it as a hotel. When it gets too bad, bring him back here. Well, he started dementing, and no one knew what that was. It was called Factor X in those days. So I would bring him home from the hospital, and I was going broke as well. I had to keep the gallery closed. Our friends wouldn't come to visit. Even his mother wouldn't have a cup of tea when she came to visit. And the night would begin with, I'd cook him supper and put him to bed. Then he'd get up and I'd find him wandering around on all fours around the flat, defecating. And so I'd pick him up, take all his clothes off, his pajamas off, run a bath, put him in the bath, do the laundry, etc. This went on for quite a while. Then on New Year's Eve, some friends of ours from Paris sent some pink champagne. I took him back to the hospital, and it was really... I said, look, I'll come and get... This was Christmas Day, rather. I took him back to the hospital. I said, I'll come on New Year's Eve and I'll bring the champagne and we'll drink it. And I went on New Year's Eve and he was on a mask, an oxygen mask. I lowered the mask. I said, Dave, I'm going to end it today. And for the first time in a long while, in a moment of absolute clarity, he smiled and said, thank you. And I walked down the hall. I went to his doctor and I said, it's time for Dave to go. You have to help him out. He said, you know what you're asking me to do? I said, do I know we won't go dancing again? Yes. So they put him on a morphine machine, and I sat for 3 days listening to this dreadful sound. Then he started fitting, which was sitting bolt upright in his bed. Enough's enough. So I took his pillow down the hall to the doctor and I said, if you don't kill Dave, I will with this. He said, you know, I said, I can do it if you can't. He said, it's against the law. Anyway, to cut a long story short, and I suppose it's now out of whatever, legally, they injected him, they put a butterfly clip in his heart and injected him in aorta while he died. Mm.
So today, and thank you so much for sharing that.
Absolutely.
Today, when you travel the world and you meet young gay men in a time when HIV awareness is probably slipping a little bit, God knows how, when people are having unsafe sex, when levels of HIV are increasing again, in your journeys, how do you feel about that?
Makes me angry, actually. Makes me very angry because not only did I lose Dave, but a boy who worked for me in the gallery, he eventually died. And eventually, I think I lost 80 friends. And now, you know, ignorance will kill.
So there's a message for gay men in particular, people listening out there now. What's the message from Noel Tovey?
The message is wear a condom.
Simple, isn't it?
When I was young, condoms were almost sold in brown paper packets, so no one knew what they were. But nowadays, they're in every supermarket, every 7-Eleven, everywhere.
And I think, Noel, with young men, because, even as a lesbian, I lost a network of friends, myself and my partner. And we did get to the stage at one stage, if we hadn't seen anybody for a while, we were too afraid to ask, has anybody seen, Bob or Jack or something. And I'm with you because the friends that especially you, of course, more than me, but you've lost a network of people. As a gay person, as Armstead Maupin says, our logical family is so important to us. And there are men out there who have lost, their networks of friends, partners, ex-partners, those people that we just anticipated would always be there, these friendships that we were forming. To lose 80 people is astronomical. It's worse than war, really.
Yeah. And, after that, I flung myself into raising money for and a friend of mine and I organized an auction. And Paul Raymond, who owned Raymond's Review Bars, who I had done the first all-male drag show for in the West End, he donated one of his tiny gay clubs. And Armistead Maupin donated a full set of his Tales of the City autograph, which I bought for £350.
Oh, fabulous.
And you still have today?
Yeah.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. Now, that voice is Noel Tovey. You're on Detours with Lindsay and Greg. And now's the time to brush off your telephone, your mobile phone, whatever you use, because there's a double pass in the offing for Melbourne Symphony Orchestra, Melbourne Town Hall, Saturday 26th of May. Experience the best of British when the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra performs William Moulton's biblical spectacular Belshazzar's Feast and Britain's ever-popular Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra. 1-300-569-949 is the number to call right now on Joy 94.9. We're on Detours. Stay with us.
Joy.
Joy.
94.9.
There's a fire starting in my heart, reaching a fever pitch and it's bringing me out the dark. Finally, I can see you crystal clear. Go ahead and sell me out and I'll lay your ship, babe.
That's Adele. How beautiful is she? And that's Rolling in the Deep on Detours with Lindsay and Greg and our special guest, Noel Tovey. I've got to say, Noel, you're one man. Whenever I bump into you in the strangest places, it could be on, but Flinders Street Station, it could be on the streets in Hawthorne, anywhere, there's an instant smile that goes on my face when I meet you. There's something that radiates out of Noel Tovey that has this love of life. Where do you get it and what is it, Noel?
I actually think I was born with it. I think my sister became a famous medium here in Melbourne. She passed away last year. We were beaten up and raped when we were very young in a house in Carlton. And eventually My father was addicted to cocaine and an alcoholic, and my mother became an alcoholic. And we were taken away in 1940. We were split up. In fact, I have a brother I've never met and a sister I haven't seen since she was 10. And people ask me why I've never been bitter about it. And I realized many, many years ago that bitterness for me was being negative. And the only way I could pay back all the kindness that's been shown to me, like Cheska, who took me under her wing at Collins Book Depot, there, and Valleywood, and other people were really very kind. Bunnybrook, mostly lesbians, strangely enough, were very kind.
Yeah,
we're
not
to
all
me.
Bad.
When were very kind to me, and the only way I could repay them was not to be bitter, was to achieve what they hoped I could achieve, or what they always told me I could achieve. And having achieved that and having lived for 78 years, and I the joy for me is just being alive.
Absolutely not. And I actually reposted a post on Facebook the other day, and it really made me take stock, because it was actually from Buddhist Boot Camp, and it was, immaturity is worrying about the events of yesterday and not focusing on tomorrow, something like that. I haven't, you know, quoted it verbatim, but it is one of those things. I think that if we think about our past and what happens, you know, and I think I've said this before, Julian Lennon, he said when he was asked about, it's when his dad was killed, and he said, oh, are you over your father's death? And he said, no, you don't get over something like that. You become accustomed to the fact that it's happened. And I think that, I know with my journey, I don't know about yours as much, but these things have happened. You can never change them. But there's always that little something out there that you think, hey, I'm alive, and hey.
Yeah. Yeats said in one of his famous poems that pain could not be transcended, but it could be absorbed.
There you go.
And I think he was right. Absolutely. And, you know, I love just to... I'll talk to perfect strangers. And I just love talking to people. And I like finding out about people. And I'm very concerned about particularly people in trouble and young people.
When you talk to people around the globe, as you're a bit of a globe setter, when you talk to people in different parts of the world, is there a difference between how people want to talk to you and their experiences, or is there a similarity that spans the globe?
I think there's a similarity that for instance, I sign deaf language. In fact, I speak four languages, but that's because I had to learn to speak them because I work in various countries. But I actually learned sign language because when I was a street kid, my best friend was a deaf kid, and we invented a language. But when I came back to Australia, I learned Auslan. Well, a few years ago, I was in New York, and this deaf guy got on the underground, and he handed me a little slip of paper with a brooch and said, would you give me $2 for this brooch? I'm deaf. I said, are you full-on deaf? And he went, where are you from? He signed, and I said, Australia. And I spoke. Well, he said, sit. And, you know, it doesn't matter what country you're in. If you're deaf, you can use iconic signs that everyone will understand. So I sat on the underground, and each station we went to, he brought another friend on another deaf friend, till finally there were about 10 deaf people all asking me about Australia, which I loved.
That's special moments in time, yeah. Noel. Absolutely, absolutely. So now your next trip, what are you doing now? And your next trip, have you planned another trip or another project that you have in the pipeline?
I've been sounded out if I'd like to go to South Africa and do my play. In 1968, when I was there, I was invited out to Johannesburg to redirect and stage The Boyfriend, which I'd done in the West End. And there was no citizenship category for Aboriginals, so I was classified as an honorary white. And during the day, I'd rehearse, and in the evening, I'd met some young students who were desperately anti-apartheid and against them, and they introduced me to another group of people, and in the evening, I'd be smuggled out to Soweto, to the township, where the conditions were really appalling, and where I'd incite everyone to rise up against apartheid. Well, now the government's just built a 12 million rand or $12 million theatre complex in Soweto, and I'd really like to do my play there.
Fabulous. Yeah, things are changing, which is good. So you might have been locked up there as well, Noel.
would you keep us up to date about, I mean, we'd love to hear your adventures returning to Soweto in South Africa. That'd be an extraordinary tale. And I think that's an opportunity for some young documentary person to get out there and follow Noel Tovey go through this epiphany. Yeah. It'd be really interesting to have someone step up and film the experience you're about to have.
Yeah, I haven't been back to, like, I've never been back to Rome. I worked in Rome. I was in Visconti's film with the Bible, and I was in, Miss Dunham was in Rome, Catherine Dunham, who I taught me here in Melbourne when she came out. And she was doing the choreography for the Bible, and she gave me a job, and I did about 20 films dubbing spaghetti westerns. And I had such a good time in Rome, La Dolce Vita in the 60s, I cannot tell you what it was like. For instance, the ballet master and I were walking the Via Sistina one night, and a gorgeous black American, he said to me, "Tondoleo, honey." Tondoleo is my nickname. I said, "Yeah, Tondoleo, you know, white man slave." He said, "Do you hear party music?" I said, "I sure do." And we went and we knocked on the door, and the butler or the came out fully clothed, and he said, "Could I have all your clothes?" And I said, "Tutti." He said, "Si, tutti." And so I said to Jimmy, I said, "He wants all our clothes." So we gave him all our clothes, and he hung them up, and we were ushered inside, and there was a hoi polloi of Italian society, all naked except the women wearing high heels and diamonds and drinking champagne. And we found the host eventually. He was surrounded by all the beautiful rent boys from the Spanish Steps on a bed with a pink counterpane.
No, La Dolce Vita.
Si. Mi piace molto.
That's the wonderful Noel Tovey. Thank you so much for joining us on Detours.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
It's been
absolutely
a pleasure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I do hope that we connect again, Noel. Yeah. Absolute inspiration. Thank
I'm
you
sure
so much.
We will.
And we'll keep in touch. Look forward to having you back after your trip to South Africa.
Terrific.
All the best. Have a good weekend, folks.
Happy trails.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. To find out more about Joy 94.9, check out joy.org.au.
Joy.
Joy.
94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.